So Saturday night here at Abaya Gary, middle of March, honing in on the last 2 weeks of our winter retreat. Weather has opened up, lots of rain this year. We're in a nice period of warmth and sunshine. Creeks are running out in the forest. It's quite beautiful, actually. Been having a number of readings over the retreat. Basic theme, with a fair amount of variation from it, on the back to basics. And I've spent a little while recently kind of looking back in my early adult years, looking at perceptions and memories of who I conceived myself to be and how I was back then and compared to now. This is what you do when you get into your late 60s and older. You start to go back and retrace your steps sometimes. How did it all come to be this way? I remember just the basic trajectory of my life before coming to this practice, my early adult years, 20s and into my 30s. Basically, living the normal life of most human beings in this world, kind of a little bit ahead of the trajectory on things like a place in the world or a vocation in the world, leaving high school early and entering college on an early program. So I started university when I was 17 and graduated with a degree in nursing at the age of 20. So my bawa tanha was pretty well developed there, my establishing a role in the world, a place in the world, was an early one. And making up for lost time, I spent a fair amount of time in my 20s, in addition to, working as a nurse, exploring kama tanha and vibhava tanha for a good 10 years or so, seeking fun, distraction, enjoyment in the realm of the senses, tiring myself enough through that to then seek annihilation through sleep or occasional mild drug use, things like that, to shut it all out after I'd engaged in, that kind of energy dispersal. Again, not uncommon probably for many people. Few wise people will find Dhamma in their 20s, but that wasn't me. So just kind of reviewing that and just watching, not a horrifically unskillful life, but certainly not a very aware one. And just wandering from experience to experience for many years, kind of blindly, but always kind of having these nagging questions hovering just underneath the surface. These, what is this all about? Why am I doing this? Where is it going? What's it leading to? Where does it end? But every time those kind of feelings or questions would emerge, there was another part of me that just didn't feel like going there, and so was able to find some other distraction or sideline to get involved with, not wanting to really explore that too deeply. So, one can do that for a whole lifetime, and one probably has done it for many lifetimes, that kind of seeking distraction from these gnawing questions that are starting to percolate underneath, just barely underneath the level of consciousness for most of us. And finally coming across some Dhamma teachings, I kind of explore, part of my distractions were exploring some of the more popular New Age approaches to spirituality, so that it wasn't coming from any place of seeking refuge from dukkha that I was exploring, but more from kind of interest in, you know, different qualities of experience that were called spiritual, but ended up just being more looking for some excitement or fun, but on a level of, you know, meditation experience that would take me into expanded states of consciousness. I can remember trying for years to have an astral projection experience, out-of-body experience, not realizing that I was living most of my life out of my body anyway, but still getting caught up in that realm. Another way of becoming, really. But then came across some of the Buddha's teachings and started to realize, oh, wow, this is addressing what it is that has been the question percolating underneath my level of consciousness for so long, and realizing, you know, some of the early teachings that I came across were kind of along the lines of the Buddha taught everything is suffering, you know, that kind of translation of there is dukkha, which did strike me as a bit extreme, but not enough to steer me away from further exploration. And then I remember a key recognition of that truth of the truth of dukkha, the truth of that there is suffering. And this is the gnawing underlying quality. It's a wonderful. I just went back and looked at it to refresh my memory. The introduction to Bhante Gunaratna's Mindfulness in Plain English, which has been around for a long time. But particularly the first few pages in the introduction, I remember reading that and it just struck me as, oh, wow, this is describing my life. And it's basically just pointing out what I just was describing, this kind of, we go through life with our blinders on, yet we know underneath that something's not right, something isn't clicking. But we put on a good show, we put on a good face, we kind of pretend it's not there, but there's this underlying illness, this dis-ease of this isn't, you know, filling the bill, this isn't working. But we do everything we can to cover that up, to squash that. Now, I remember there's one description in there of a, you know, like you go to a party, everybody's laughing. You know, you see the brittleness of it, the kind of the facade, fun on the outside, fear on the inside. And I just sort of like, this is truth. This is noble truth number one. So that was a very strong motivating force for me to read on and to explore. And start to pick up some of the teachings of the Buddha. There's also the, you know, not only our own personal dukkha, but in the role that I found myself in working as a nurse, the encountering the dukkha of many people in different ways, old age, sickness, death, and a couple of very eye-opening experiences for me just in the late 80s, at the peak of the AIDS epidemic, working with a number of people who were in Seattle who were, you know, actively dying with AIDS before a lot of the treatments were available. And a couple of them just so profoundly disturbing. One, a middle-aged man who was not doing well and was on the way out. But how he just totally, totally closed up, sunk into a profound, impenetrable depression, and just passed away in that state. And my feeling of helplessness, you know, and that feeling of why couldn't I find something to do to help? What, you know, feeling responsible for not being able to offer any kind of solace to this person, and seeing somebody die like that, And in another situation, similar, except a young man who was not overwhelmed by depression, but overwhelmed by anger and resentment to the point of throwing furniture around the room when I would be visiting him in his home, and not being able to penetrate that. And essentially, he died that way as well. So feeling overwhelmed and responsible at other people's dukkha, at other people's suffering, and blaming myself for not being able to be present or not being able to be, more responsive in a useful way. And the event that was very eye-opening was that right at that time, I've told this before, so I'll just briefly mention it, very significant, was going to a Ruth Denison retreat, one of my first retreats as a layman, and basically halfway through telling my story to her about this particular person and my sense of being overwhelmed in grief, and her basically throwing a bucket of cold water on my face and saying, "You're a basket case," more or less. And it might have seemed kind of harsh, but it was like, a refreshing way of pulling me out of that kind of state of mind and realizing that I was just creating my own suffering. This was not due to external circumstances. It was, myself just creating this dukkha that I didn't need to create. And that was a real turning point in my practice, in my, my early days of practice, about the involvement, the self-involvement in both of those situations, and the responsibility that I can take to examine, look at, and develop a strategy to gradually work towards an understanding of dukkha and how it ceases and how I can develop a path of practice around that. So dukkha is, as the Buddha says, the experience of dukkha can result in two things. More dukkha, if you just continue on, buy into it, and just keep repeating it in different ways, or a spiritual path that seeks the end of it. Those are your options. So I think I still create more dukkha for myself, but realizing that the other alternative is a lot more useful, using it as motivation for a spiritual path for seeking an ending of it. So this is what it's all about, and we've been coming back to the basics, trying to reframe our approach to what the Buddha says he teaches, two things, dukkha and the end of dukkha, always coming back to that basic footprint. So fast forward to yesterday, and we were having some readings, and a question came up about dependent origination, and the question around, particularly the cessation side of dependent origination, with the ceasing of ignorance, there can be the ceasing of sankhara, volitional formations, and then the cessation of consciousness, and then into mind and body, sense bases, contact, feeling, that whole level of existence, in a sense. And teasing some questions around, well, what does that mean with the arahant? It sounds kind of like annihilation, that everything starts to cease, including body, mind, sense bases, experience. How we hold that, because the arahant is still alive. And then basically the discussion around the fact that it is, at least in my understanding, revolving more around not, an annihilationist standpoint, but the non-identification, the non-making of a problem, and not carrying ignorance around with one all the way through the experience. That doesn't mean that the khandhas cease to exist, but they exist in a different way that's devoid of ignorance and is informed by true knowledge. And then Lungpa very astutely pointed out that the whole process of dependent origination was around the origination and the cessation of suffering. Nirodha being in dependent origination, the dukkha nirodha. So that's the ending, the cessation of suffering is what that's all about, not existence. So again, the Buddha's teachings, even on the most profound level, keep pointing towards origin and cessation of dukkha, of suffering. This is what it's all about. And as I was kind of mulling this over today, there was a sutta that came to mind that I go back to over and over again, a very pithy, fairly short, quite short, page-long sutta, but is jam-packed with significance, every line of it. And it's called the Kacchanagota Sutta from the Samyutta Nikaya. For people who want to look at it later, it's chapter 12, number 15. From the Nidana Samyutta. And just to paraphrase it a little, it's when the monk Kacchanagota comes to the Buddha and asks the Buddha, what is, you know, it is said there is right view, what is right view? And the Buddha replies something along the lines of this world, for the most part, the world of experience, the beings in the world, for the most part, live by either a notion of what he says existence or a notion of non-existence, which the commentaries interpret, and I think quite accurately, as meaning the notions of eternalism or the beliefs around eternalism and the beliefs and notions around annihilationism. That these are the two extreme views that most of the world adheres to, one or the other. Eternalism being the view that there is no ending to experience. There is either, you know, continuous rebirth or, you know, rebirth into a fixed place like in the Christian heaven. Or the Christian hell, which are permanent and everlasting, or continuous rebirth into different realms, but that it goes on forever, eternally, without question. Or the standpoint of annihilationism, non-existence, if you will, that is basically the materialistic view of, yes, there's experience, an existence being now, and at the end of this lifetime, with the demise of this body, then that's it. Extinction, no more, nothing. So these are the two extremes that the world finds itself mostly holding to, one or the other. And then he says, but for one who sees clearly with right wisdom the arising of the world of experience, there can be no notion of non-existence or annihilationism. Because one sees, and this is, you know, my reflection on it, you know, one sees that all experience, unenlightened experience for most of us, arises from clinging, craving, these qualities, these pushes in the mind, these tendencies in the mind. Craving for sensuality, for becoming, for non-becoming. And that as long as that exists, as long as that is present, as long as that is still part of the mind stream, then there will always be something arising from that birth, because becoming and birth are the result of clinging, craving. And that there's no end to that, that just on the dissolution of this body, those forces don't just cease. They're not only dependent on the existence of the four elements body. They just push into the next form of existence, whatever that is. They're too powerful. So for one who sees correctly with right wisdom, the arising of the world, there is no notion of cessation. There's no notion of non-existence. And for one who sees clearly the cessation of the world and how things that arise from a cause have their time and then pass away, everything that arises passes away. For one who sees that clearly in all circumstances, then there's no notion of complete annihilation. I mean, complete eternalism, foreverness, because one sees clearly all that arises passes away, and that with the fully liberated mind, then there is that kind of cessation of rebirth potentiality happening, and whereas it's not an annihilationist viewpoint, it's a cessation of dukkha, a cessation of becoming, a cessation of being in the way that we know it. So for one who sees this clearly, neither of those two extremes will arise. And then the Buddha steers it back to his teaching of there is basically suffering and the end of suffering through the recitation of the dependent origination, with ignorance as condition, volitional formations arise, etc. And when ignorance ceases, volitional formations, etc., will also cease. And thus there is this end of suffering that is a potential. So this is the basic foundation for our practice, this potentiality to transcend this powerful dukkha that we all experience at some level or another, and that we all realize in our heart of hearts is what we're seeking relief from. So we have the path of practice and to bring us to that level of understanding and release. What comes to mind is just something else I stumbled across yesterday and listened to. I didn't stumble across it. Lungpa passed it on to me as a recommended talk that he had just listened to of Ajahn Dun, very famous, not very famous, kind of somewhat unknown Thai Ajahn who passed away in the 50s. I think we figured out. Oh no, the 80s. It was the 80s, yeah, that we determined. That was a very beautiful talk, simple and profound in the way that it was offered, and very emblematic of Ajahn Dun's simplicity, but profoundness. In that basically it was read, this translation was read in English as a almost a guided meditation, very, very well done by Aya Jaya, Samaneri Jayasara, right? She did a very excellent job with that. But essentially, him pointing back to the cause of suffering, which he states in a very simple teaching, but the cause of suffering being the mind sent out, the mind that goes out, and as he further explored in this teaching that I listened to yesterday, the mind going out to the six sense bases, going out to sights, sounds, tastes, smells, tactile sensations, and the constructing mind itself, the thinking mind, the emotional mind, that part of the mind process, that is the origin of dukkha, the cause of dukkha. It's the mind constantly being pulled out from its base, from its home base, and getting entwined with and involved with and creating stories and problems around all of these bits and pieces that come into our awareness through the sense spaces based on greed, hatred, and delusion, reaching out to grab hold. And how the basically we just need to keep pulling back that process back to the mind just seeing the mind just being with itself in its pure state, not entangled with, not involved with these external pulls. And resting in that clarity of awareness, that non-grasping, non-moving clarity of pure knowing, essentially, the mind itself. And if the distractions are, you know, overwhelming, or if there is a lot of emotional turmoil, particularly, then that kind of meditation really isn't appropriate. But using the soothing objects that we have of an object of meditation, he used the example of the mantra Bhutto to help settle the mind, to help settle the emotional turmoil or the difficulties or the distractions. You could also use other objects that result in that kind of more peaceful state of mind until it settles down. So being with the distraction, being with the being pulled out into the realm of the sense bases and thoughts and emotions, allowing that to run its course, gently soothing, gently coaxing it back to stillness, and then allowing the mind to return back to the mind rather than being entangled. And that is essentially, you know, this is my paraphrasing, he states it much more beautifully, but that's essentially the practice leading to the cessation of suffering, so that being able to do that process of having the mind just stay with the mind, seeing the mind in and of itself and being there will result in the end of suffering. So this is also, based on a lot of foundational building that we need to do, foundation building. It can't happen without virtue, sila, precepts, living a harmless life, allowing the mind to settle down through those kinds of practices, generosity, gladdening the mind. These are all, we can't quite get to that state of just the mind's seeing the mind and not going anywhere without a lot of foundational practice to support it. And then also living a life of simplicity, allowing oneself to explore peaceful ways of livelihood, settling down the engagement in the world, using nature, like living in a forest monastery to help soothe the senses, settle the mind. Sense restraint is an important part of the practice. Not going out to places where we just, will get constantly pulled out of our home base. So we have to be willing to make some changes in the way we live our lives to help this process of being able to see the cause of suffering and how to end it. But what we get in return is incalculably worth it, priceless. We get much more than we have to give up. And we get it through giving up, through relinquishment. So these are just some thoughts around the topic of dukkha, motivation to seek the end of it rather than getting caught up and entwined in more dukkha, compounding it, finding an understanding of how it arises and passes away, bringing that into our own experience, and learning how to stay with the knowing mind that doesn't crave or cling, get itself entangled in the continuation of that whole process, and finding the supports, any support we can find that's going to help us in that process. I'll leave it there for tonight's reflection.